O merciful one, Master Kripal, we have kept our hopes on you. This is Bhajan Hey Dayal Guru Kripal on page 68. There's no one like you. There are many like me. We got tired of bathing in the waters. We did many burning austerities. Day and night I weep and remember you. Come soon and meet me. Why are you delaying? Oh, beautiful one, in order to meet you, I heard many criticisms. Now the soul of Ajayb has awakened, because in the end, the beautiful one has visited. Oh, merciful one, Master Kripal, we have kept our hopes on you. Bhajan of Sanchi on page 68.
Hey, Dayal Guru Kripal.
Hey, Dayal Guru Kripal.
Rakhiya Satariya.
Rakhiya Satariya.
Tere jaisa koi hor na,
tere jaisa koi hor na,
mere jahiya bateriya. Tere mil anedika tira sonia.
Tere mil anedika tira sonia.
Nindia sunia bateria.
Nindia sunia bateria. Nindia guru kirpa. Nindia guru kirpa. Rakia
Jagi Jinda Ajay Badi.
Jagi Jinda Ajay Badi.
Akar Sone Ne Paya Periya.
Sone Ne Paya Periya. Heya Guru Kirpa. Heya Guru Kirpa.
Merciful One, Master Kripal, we have kept our hopes on you. Our next bhajan is on page 29, Lika Navalia to O.K. O writer of fortunes, graciously write on my heart love for the Master. In my hands write the service of the Guru, write the sacrifice of my body and mind for the Guru. On my tongue write the name of the Guru. For my ears write the voice of the sound current. On my forehead write the light of the Guru. For my eyes write the darshan of my Guru. Don't write one thing, separation from the Guru. It doesn't matter if separation from the whole world is written. O writer of fortunes, graciously write on my heart love for the Master. Bhajan of Sanchi on page 29.
Lika Navalia tu hoke de ala lika de Mary hira devi che gurada fia. Seva Guru Jidi
Adavi Chalikade Seva Guru Jidi
Meritana Mana Guru Te Varalikade
Meritana Mana Guru Te Che Gurada
Tele Gade Namaguru Jida
Jiva Tele Gade Namaguru Jida
Merakana Vicha Dunadi Avazalika De
Mere Hira Devi Che Kurada Pyara Lika De Lika Navaliya Tu
Te lika dehi jota guru jidi
mata te lika dehi jota guru jidi
Mary Ankavicha guru da didara lika dehi
Mere Hira Devi Che Kurada Pyara Lika De Lika Navaliya Tu Ho Ke Pyara Lika De Mere Hira Devi Che
Naliki mere Sate Guru Davichora
Ike Naliki mere Sate Guru Davichora
Bhavi Chute Jaye Sara Sansara Lika Dehe
Mere Hira Devi Che Kurada Pyara Lika Dehe Lika Navaliya Tu Ho
Writer of fortunes, graciously write on my heart love for the master. That bhajan we just sang is, of course, was written. Sanchi has said that he wrote that in his childhood, which I'm not sure exactly how young he was, but it was before he had ever heard of Kripal, and it was in anticipation of the guru that he wrote it. I think it may be his first bhajan. I want to read a few paragraphs from The Crown of Life. This is the chapter on Advaitism that we have been looking at over the past few months off and on, not always, not every time, but Advaitism, of course, is the teaching of Shankaracharya, who Master has characterized in the early part of the chapter as the true philosopher. That is, he called him Shankara, the prodigy from South India, arose to preach the true philosophy of Advaitism. And Advaita, the Advaita Vedanta in India, is the teaching of absolute non-dualism. That is, that there is ultimately only one reality, that reality is underlies everything, and it is not plural. We would say, in a theistic formulation of it, we would say that that reality is God, and that there is no other except God. And we are all parts of God, and we will know true peace and happiness only when we find ourselves back into being aware of the nature of God. It is, however, possible to understand Advaita Vedanta without thinking of it theistically. We don't have to, because the personal God is also one manifestation of the ultimate reality. And the masters do, if we follow their teachings far enough, they do maintain that the ultimate reality lies beyond all personhood. This is the, of course, the meaning of the term, the ultimate meaning of the term Radhaswami. This is the paragraph called The Nature of Self. And of course, self, spelt here with a capital S, is the English representation of the term Atman, which means that, actually it's identical with Brahman, which is the undifferentiated, unprojected, absolute nature of God. And the Atman is identical with the Brahman, except that the Atman is, we can understand it as that part of the Brahman that exists within us. That we are, basically, if we go deep enough within ourselves, this is what we find. And that is generally represented in English as self with a capital S. In Sanskrit and Hindi, of course, the term jiva, J-I-V-A, exists to describe what we usually call the self in English, which is reproduced in these various books as self with a lowercase s. So, with that in mind, when I read self here, understand it with a capital S, and it is refers to the Atman. Though we know that the self exists, yet we do not know what it is. For knowledge itself follows the self and is due to and because of the self. The true nature of the self may, however, be comprehended by the self if it could be stripped of all the enshrouding sheaths of senses, mind, understanding, and will in which it is clothed and covered. What is then left is variously described as undifferentiated consciousness, eternal knowledge, or pure awareness, and is characterized by the light of the great void. It is the supreme principle whose essential nature is self-effulgence. It is infinite, transcendental, and the essence of absolute knowledge. It has three attributes of Sat, Chit, and Anand. That is pure existence, pure knowledge, and pure bliss. As the self is complete in itself and by itself, it has no activity of its own, nor has any need for it, nor requires any outside agency. All-pervading and self-existent, it knows no limits and no motives. Individual knowledge and consciousness. Though the ultimate reality is the non-dual spirit, yet determinate knowledge and empirical experience, that is, the way in which we ordinarily live, presuppose the existence of 1. The knower, or the subject that knows, apart from the internal organ behind the senses and the object known. The knowing mind is but a reflecting mirror that reflects the luminosity of the Atman in which knowledge grows. 2. The process of knowledge as determined by modifications in the internal organ. The vrittis, or undulations creating ripples and bubbles in the stream of consciousness. These vrittis are of four kinds: the indeterminate manas, or the mind stuff; the determinate buddhi, or intelligent will; self-sense, ahankar, or the self-assertive ego; and the subconscious, chit, or the deep and hidden potencies. 3. The object known through the light of the Atman, as reflected by the internal organ, or antakaran. And those are the presuppositions and the assumptions with which we live our life, analyzed out in a philosophical way. And those four kinds of vrittis, chit, manas, buddhi, and ahankar, are, in the psychology of the masters, generally considered the four components of the mind on the level on which we usually live. And sometimes when master differentiates between mind and intellect, he is usually differentiating between ahankar and chit, although it's possible that he sometimes is involving others of the four. All right, knowledge and its sources. Knowledge is of two kinds: ultimate and final, or empirical and relative. Knowledge in its ultimate reality is a state of being and never grows. It is already there and is revealed by the light of the Atman, which transcends at once both the subject apprehending and the object apprehended, beyond which there is nothing. True knowledge, purely an action of the soul, and is perfect in itself and independent of the senses and the sense organs. An all-knowing mind, says Professor J. M. Murray, embraces the totality of being under the aspect of eternity. As we gain our entrance into the world of being, a total vision is ours. According to Shankara, highest knowledge is the immediate witness of reality itself, for then the knower and the known become one reality. But the real self, which is pure awareness, cannot be the object of knowledge. The empirical knowledge of the external world is just like animal knowledge. It is based on and derived from the sense organs, and as such has forms and modes, all of which are conspicuous by their absence from true knowledge. But nothing becomes real till it is experienced. Even a proverb is no proverb until it is illustrated in actual life and practice. All empirical knowledge is revealed either by perception or by scriptural testimony. The human perception has never been considered true, perfect, and accurate. One may see a snake in a rope or a ghost in the stump of a tree. Generally, things are not what they seem to be. The colors of things we see are those that are not absorbed by them, but are rejected and thrown out. The redness of the rose is not part of the rose, but something alien to it. Again, inference and scriptural testimony are not altogether infallible. The source of inference is previous experience, which is itself fallible, and even if it were not, situations in the present may not wholly fit in with the knowledge gained in the past. This is the case even with intuition, which is the sum total of all experience in the subconscious. A cloud of smoke on the top of a distant hill may be indicative of fire, or it may be a sheet of fog. Similarly, scriptural testimony, though admitted as an infallible and certain source of knowledge, cannot always be treated as such. The Vedas, which constitute the divine knowledge, appear and disappear with the rise and dissolution of each cycle of time. They are supposed to be an inexhaustible mine of universal and ideal knowledge. But the term knowledge implies a record of spiritual experiences gained at the supersensory planes. The moment the experiences thus gained are translated into human language and reduced to writing, they acquire form and method. And the moment they acquire form and method, they lose their freshness and life, their quality of limitless being. That which cannot be limited or defined begins to be treated as something defined and limited. And instead of the scriptures giving vital knowledge, they tend to distract men from it by offering only abstractions. At best, they can only point toward the truth, but they can never give it. The concepts of the universal as contained therein remain as mere concepts, for they can neither be received, inferred, nor correctly communicated. They begin to have meaning only when one learns to rise above the empirical plane and experiences truth for himself. At which point, of course, we are able to come into the point or the perspective, the angle of vision, the point of view of the people who wrote the scriptures in the first place. And we say, oh yeah, this is what they meant. This is a very important writing in regard to the masters. Sanchi in the Palace of Love presents the same idea in just a couple of sentences, but it's the same. The point is, once something is reduced to writing, is different than it was before it was reduced to writing. I love books, and I read all the time, and I get a great deal out of them. But the fact is that this is the ultimate truth, what is being said here. From the above, one comes to the irresistible conclusion that seeing, or direct and immediate perception, is above all proof and testimony. It is seeing in the pure light of the Atman, which is free from even the least shadow of correlativity. It is nothing but a direct, integral experience of the soul. Shruti, or revealed scripture, without first-hand inner experience, is sound without sense. All flights of thought, imagination or fancy, and all empirical knowledge are inadequate and cannot do justice to truth or the ultimate reality. Anubhava, which means roughly first-hand spiritual experience, is verily the real and absolute knowledge, and is knowledge of the absolute. It is the self-certifying experience of the soul, which bears testimony to the recorded spiritual experience of the sages as given in the Shrutis, or the scriptures. I want to read from chapter 4 of The Stranger of Galilee. This, of course, is my commentary on the Sermon on the Mount, which is, of course, scripture reduced to writing, as is, in fact, all of the Master's books. But that doesn't mean there isn't a lot of value in studying them anyway. You know, it's like Master said in the thing, they're not the truth, but they point toward the truth. And since so much of us is engaged in being pointed away from the truth, anything that helps us get pointed toward the truth is useful. And that's the real use of the scriptures, of course. When they become what we call in the West, bibliolatry, that is when the book is worshipped as such without, you know, any sense of what it's ultimately lies at the bottom of it, what it's pointing toward, then that's another thing. But this is the chapter called Blessed Are the Merciful. It's the commentary on Matthew 5:7. Blessed are the merciful, for they will receive mercy. This has an exact parallel in the Babylonian Talmud, a tractate on the Shabbat, 151b, whoever has pity on people will obtain pity from heaven. It is another indication that Jesus was teaching spiritual or esoteric Judaism. If we, one of the points I make in the introduction to this book, and it's important to make it, is, of course, it has to do with the way we use labels and words. But Jesus was not a Christian, you know. This is a thing that we have to bear in mind. Christianity is something that came up after him in order to make sense of or reduce to writing for the benefit of others, or however we want to put it, whatever people had received from him. And it's a thing in itself. But Jesus is coming out of the framework of esoteric Judaism, the same line of teachers and so forth that eventually resulted in the Kabbalah. And another branch coming from Jesus himself became what we now call Gnosis, the esoteric early Christians. But Jesus is coming out of the fact that some of these things are in the Talmud also, which was taking form at the same time, or beginning to take form at the same time, is an indication that he was not an isolated phenomenon suddenly appearing out of nowhere from heaven. You know, he was part of a recognized spiritual movement that existed then, and which he was a representative of. And that was within institutional Judaism. It was not institutional Judaism, but it existed within it in the same way that St. Francis was a Catholic and the Baal Shem Tov was a Jew and Maulana Rumi was a Muslim and so forth. Like the other Beatitudes and like the teachings of the Masters in general, this verse is not a commandment. Rather, we are given a glimpse of the reality that if we can do this, we will reap a certain result. The blessing works within the law of karma, and it also cancels out the law of karma. This is a feature of all the blessings, that is, in the sermon, the first seven blessings in the Sermon on the Mount, and the Master's teachings, but it is especially clear in this verse. How does it work? If we have mercy on people, then as we sow, so shall we reap. Within the law of karma, it works. At the same time, the law of karma is basically merciless. The law of the negative power depends on the absence of mercy. If mercy is shown, karma cannot work. In the Hindi language, the negative power is referred to as kal, and the positive power is dayal, which mean time and mercy, respectively. The chief characteristic of the negative power, the lord of judgment, the lord of karma, is time. The characteristic of the positive power, the ultimate creator, the source of our own essence, is mercy. Time, by definition, is merciless. Anyone who has lived for even 3 or 4 years must recognize that truth. When mercy enters the world of time, it short-circuits it, stands it on its head, and presents a paradox. It introduces a point of view that fundamentally does not mesh with the world of time. And that is why, when working within the law of karma, we show mercy to others, we begin to get mercy back. At the same time, by showing mercy, by not demanding what fairness or justice would demand, we begin the process of short-circuiting or canceling out the law of karma in our own lives. And if enough of us did this consistently, we could cancel karma in the life of the universe as a whole. In The Way of the Saints, page 352, Master Kripal Singh explores the underlying reason why this is so. Next comes love. Love for one and love for all. Love thy neighbor, for for love is the fulfilling of the law of God. He that loveth not knoweth not God, for God is love. A little leaven of love will leaven the whole lump and infect all those who are around you. Again, perfect love casteth out fear. Whensoever there is the least fear lurking, know it for certain that love hath not yet perfected in that heart. Naturally enough, from love spring forth the ideas of service and sacrifice. Love believes in giving, giving away the best you have and not accepting anything in return, for that would be a barter and not love. Service before self is what love teaches. By love serve one another is what the Apostle Paul taught to the Galatians and through them to all mankind. If we look critically, we will soon realize that all service which we seem to be doing to others is not to anybody else, but to the one selfsame self, pervading everywhere and in all, including our seemingly individualized self, clothed in raiments of flesh and bones. This being the case, there is no ground for claiming any credit whatever. Loving service must therefore flow freely, fully, and naturally, as a matter of course, refreshing all hearts, for it will convert an otherwise dreary and desolate earth into a veritable Garden of Eden, for which we so earnestly pray every day, but find it receding from us the more we wish it. The underlying truth, now my comment picks up, behind all the Beatitudes or blessings is this: we have mercy on others, and we thereby obtain mercy because the others to whom we give mercy are in fact ourselves. There is no difference. When we have mercy on others, we have mercy on ourselves. Note this very similar passage from Master Kripal's address at the Third World Religions Conference in 1965 in Delhi. He delivered it in Hindi, but it was translated into English and later published under the title The Essence of Religion and the Way of the Saints. It constitutes a very basic part of the Master's teaching. Consider its relation to the passage above, which was originally found in a circular letter sent only to his initiates. This is from a talk given to approximately 150,000 people, including world religious leaders from all different sects. With the yardstick of love, the very essence of God's character with us, let us probe our hearts. Is our life an efflorescence of God's love? Are we ready to serve one another with love? Do we keep our hearts open to the healthy influences coming from outside? Are we patient and tolerant toward those who differ from us? Are our minds coextensive with the creation of God and ready to embrace the totality of His being? Do we bleed inwardly at the sight of the downtrodden and the depressed? Do we pray for the sick and suffering humanity? If we do not do any of these things, we are yet far removed from God and from religion, no matter how loud we may be in our talk, and pious in our platitudes, and pompous in our proclamations. With all our inner craving for peace, we have failed and failed hopelessly to serve the cause of God's peace on earth. Ends and means are interlocked and cannot be separated from each other. We cannot have peace so long as we try to achieve it with warlike means and with the weapons of destruction and extinction. With the germs of hatred in our hearts, racial and color bars rankling within us, thoughts of political domination and economic exploitation surging in our bloodstream, we are working for wrecking the social structure which we have so strenuously built, and not for peace, unless it be peace of the grave, but certainly not for a living peace born of mutual love and respect, trust and concord, that may go to ameliorate mankind and transform this earth into a paradise for which we so fervently pray and preach from pulpits and platforms, and yet, as we proceed, it recedes away into the distant horizon. Again, Master uses the same image of the receding paradise, the retreating Garden of Eden. It is leaving us because we don't grasp that we must have mercy on others because they are ourselves. When we give mercy to them, we are giving it to ourselves. There is another dimension of this which is also of great importance. Having mercy on others implies power over others. We usually use the terms mercy or pity interchangeably concerning the people over whom we have power. We ask someone with more power than we have in a given situation to have mercy on us, and we show mercy to those who do not have as much power as we have. Obviously, this blessing, and the Master's teaching it reflects, implies that we will be very aware of our position whenever we have this kind of authority over others. That is precisely the point at which we must be very careful. The poet William Blake deals with this in two of his most famous poems. The first one, The Divine Image, is from Songs of Innocence. To mercy, pity, peace, and love, all pray in their distress, and to these virtues of delight return their thankfulness. For mercy, pity, peace, and love is God our Father dear, and mercy, pity, peace, and love is man his child in care. For mercy has a human heart, pity a human face, and love the human form divine, and peace the human dress. Then every man of every clime that prays in his distress prays to the human form divine, love, mercy, pity, peace. And all must love the human form, in heathen, Turk, or Jew, where mercy, love, and pity dwell, there God is dwelling too. This beautiful poem clearly invokes the teaching that mercy has a human heart and pity a human face. One of Blake's principal messages, one that he shares with the masters, is that in the long run, God has to work through the people around us. In the corresponding poem called The Human Abstract from Songs of Experience, Blake shows how this usually works. The first two verses are especially relevant. Pity would be no more if we did not make somebody poor, and mercy no more could be if all were as happy as we. And mutual fear brings peace till the selfish loves increase. Then cruelty knits a snare and spreads his baits with care. The poem goes on to describe the way most of us are, unfortunately, most of the time, and it throws a sharp light on the fact that mercy and pity can come only from someone who has power over a person who is relatively powerless. If we truly have mercy, we would abolish the distinctions of authority that separate human beings from one another, or we might say living forms from one another, since animals are very much the objects of our power or our mercy. However, the only way to abolish those divisions would be for everyone to show mercy indiscriminately. Then those power divisions would be cancelled out. The Garden of Eden or the paradise Master Kripal spoke of, would be created, the ultimate goal to which all these things are leading. As we go through life, we will sometimes be in a position where power will be exerted over us, and sometimes we will be the ones exercising power over others. The psychology of it usually works in such a way that when we absorb the consequences of other people's power over us, we then display that in our dealings with those over whom we have control. This is precisely the sequence of events that has to be cancelled out. It has to stop somewhere, and it can only stop at the point where we are the ones exercising power. We cannot influence those who have authority over us except by being merciful to those over whom we have power. If we show mercy to those who are dependent on us for mercy, then according to karmic law, and according to the cancellation of the karmic law that this implies, those with power over us will eventually show us mercy. Sooner or later they will do it. All of this is what lies behind the Master's teachings on raising children. The group of people over whom adults have the most consistent power is certainly children. They are subject to our whims, our decisions, and our desires every minute of the day and night. The May 1990 Sant Bani is one of the most important issues ever published because it contains both Master Kripal's and Sanchi's views of bringing up our children. The following extracts from Master Kripal's letters are found in that issue, though they were originally published in the June 1971 Satsang Desh. And this is a quote: "The raising of children is a virtuous duty. The young ones imitate their parents, who should reflect peace, harmony, and sobriety by leading a disciplined life full of spiritual beatitude," which of course means blessing. "The assertive attitude of dear," and I have to, this letter was written to Judith, actually, my wife, and it's about our son Eric, and this is, so it says, "The assertive attitude of dear Eric," although it's blank in the book, "shows the greatness of his soul. Self-assertion, Eric was giving us a very hard time when he was 3 or 4, something like that. Very demanding guy. You would never know, I mean, as an adult, he is the humblest and most loving and most merciful of people, and a delight to be around. But as a kid, he was something else, which is at least at this age. Self-assertion is the innate attribute of soul, which is all divine in miniature scale. This kind of sentiment is predominant in promising personalities who inherit congenial environments most helpful for their spiritual progress. Satsangi parents who have trouble with self-assertive children should bear this in mind. Master is saying that people, including children, who are self-assertive, are living the way they should be living. In other words, their soul is accurately manifesting itself. When we do what the psychologist Alice Miller calls poisonous pedagogy, breaking the spirit of children, teaching them to obey, teaching them to leave aside their own point of view and conform to ours, we are doing precisely what Master says we are not to do. One way of showing mercy is to let other people's souls manifest themselves. Self-assertion is the innate attribute of soul, which is all divine in miniature scale, which is, of course, a quote from Master's letter above, a condition which is meant to be. People who are born into situations where they can progress spiritually, into homes that allow for growth, are going to be more self-assertive than others. The Master is sending this kind of person as a gift to us. If we don't know how to deal with the child, that's another thing. But Master's meaning is clear. self-assertion predominates in promising personalities who inherit congenial environments most helpful for their spiritual progress. And then that letter continues. So far as his demands are concerned, these should be met with lovingly as far as possible, so far as these are legitimate and within the scope of his raising. The young sentiments should not in any way be injured. It is the unbounded love of the parents for the children which makes them bold, brave, and adventurous in their lives. Of all the sentences that any master has ever said about this subject, this seems to be the most important. As parents, we want it both ways. We want our children to be carbon copies of what we think and what we are on the one hand, but when they grow up, we want them to be bold, brave, and adventurous. The first does not produce the latter. Boldness, bravery, and the willingness to take chances is produced by the unbounded, infinite love of the parents for the children. Why is this so? It's because perfect love, infinite love, unbounded love casteth out fear, as Master has just quoted from the Bible in the circular letter above. And the letter continues, you must be an affectionate and bravely stern mother so far as your love and discipline is concerned toward your children. Your good action of sitting with them regularly for listening to the sound current is appreciated and will be helpful for their spiritual growth. Please convey my love to them. Note that the Master does not say that children should not be disciplined, nor that they should be allowed to run free and do anything that appeals to them. There are times when it is not good for children to be allowed to do anything they want, and somehow parents have to be wise enough to determine what is crucial to their growth and what is not. The important thing is that we must operate from the basic understanding that self-assertion is the innate attribute of the soul, which is all divine in miniature scale, that it predominates in promising personalities who inherit congenial environments most helpful to their spiritual progress, that our children's demands should be met with lovingly and their young sentiments not injured, and that it is the unbounded love of the parents which makes them bold, brave, and adventurous. If we raise them with that understanding always in mind, then when discipline is necessary to prevent them from doing something self-destructive, it will be the exception to the rule, and it will still come within the bounds of mercy. Master Kripal's second letter is in some ways even more revolutionary than the first. And this is a different letter now. You may please try to lavish the things for her which she is prone to steal. This is, of course, obviously a letter about a kid who is stealing things. You will find that when everything is procured for her, the tendency to obtain them by stealing will be overcome in due course. Simultaneously, you can ingrain in her mind that anything and everything she is desirous of having will be provided for her. The understanding and compassion and knowledge of human weakness that these few words reveal is perhaps not surprising considering who wrote the letter. After all, he was the living master of the universe at the time he wrote it, and why should he not see things that way, this way? At the same time, this particular passage is breathtaking because it is a practical instance of having mercy on others so that mercy will be given to us. When we treat our children, including our stepchildren, the children we teach in class, the children we babysit, or any children we come in contact with, in accordance with the philosophy of this letter, we ingrain in her mind that anything and everything she is desirous of having will be provided for her. We thereby take away what can be called the existential fear of being alive, which is what Mastanaji calls the sin of birth in his Bhajan Nachare. We eliminate the reasons which caused the person, in this case the child, to act in what seems to be a negative and antisocial manner. The motives for such behavior are removed. When we do that, we don't lose the child. She remains bound with us in a loving, mutually reliant relationship through which a great deal of mercy is shown. But we must realize that parents need the child's mercy too. Later in life, the tables will be turned, and when our children become older, they will have power over us. They will usually give us what we have given them. If we have shown mercy to them, they will have mercy on us. The psychologist Alice Miller, who was mentioned earlier, has expressed a psychological theory that underlies the Master's teachings in this regard. And in her book, Thou Shalt Not Be Aware, she states a revolutionary point of view. If there really should be a loving God, he would not burden us with prohibitions. He would love us as we are, would not demand obedience from us, not feel threatened by criticism, not threaten us with hell, not fill us with fear, not put our loyalty to the test, not mistrust us, would let us experience and express our feelings and needs, confident that this is what we need if we are to learn the meaning of a strong and genuine love, a love that is the opposite of fulfilling one's duty and being obedient, and that grows only out of the experience of being loved. A child cannot be raised to be loving, neither by being beaten, nor by well-meaning words. No reprimands, sermons, explanations, good examples, threats, or prohibitions can make a child capable of love. A child who is preached to learns only to preach. And a child who is beaten learns to beat others. A person can be raised to be a good citizen, a brave soldier, a devout Jew, Catholic, Protestant, or atheist, even to be a devout psychoanalyst, but not to be a vital and free human being. And only vitality and freedom, not the compulsions of child-rearing, open the wellsprings of a genuine capacity to love. Children who are respected learn respect. Children who are cared for learn to care for those weaker than themselves. Children who are loved for what they are cannot learn intolerance. In an environment such as this, they will develop their own ideals, which can be nothing other than humane, since they grow out of the experience of love. And I'm going to stop there as time is moving on. But that quote from Alice Miller is what you could say is the philosophical underpinning of what lies, of the way the masters observe these things. And of course, raising of children is only one aspect of having mercy over others. There are many others also.
Guru Nanak Sahib says that, O Lord, what do we ask from you? I only ask for the dust of the feet of the saints. Nanak says that I only ask for this boon from God Almighty that He may make me the dust of the feet of the saints.
ਕੌਣ ਧੂੜੀ ਮੰਗਦਾ ਹੈ ਜਿਨ੍ਹਾਂ ਨੂੰ ਧੂੜੀ ਦੀ ਕਦਰ ਹੁੰਦੀ ਹੈ ਜਿਹੜੇ ਅੰਦਰ ਜਾਂਦੇ ਹੈ ਜਿਨ੍ਹਾਂ ਨੂੰ ਪਤਾ ਹੈ ਕਿ ਪਰਮਾਤਮਾ ਨੇ ਸਾਡੀ ਆਤਮਾ ਦੇ ਰਹਿਣ ਕਰਨ ਵਾਸਤੇ ਭੇਜਿਆ ਹੈ ਉਹਨਾਂ ਨੂੰ ਵੀ ਕਦਰ ਹੁੰਦੀ ਹੈ
Who asks for the dust of the feet of the saints? Only those who really appreciate it. Appreciate it, only those who really know the value of it, only those who go within, only those who know that how much the masters have showered grace upon them.
ਮੈਂ ਤੁਹਾਨੂੰ ਪੱਤਰ ਪਾਇਆ ਸੀ ਮੇਰਾ ਲੜਕਾ ਬਿਮਾਰ ਸੀਗਾ ਤੁਸੀਂ ਲਿਖਿਆ ਸੀਗਾ ਉਹ ਰਾਜੀ ਨਹੀਂ ਹੋਇਆ ਕਈ ਐਸੀਆਂ ਗੱਲਾਂ ਕਰੇ ਲੇਕਿਨ ਪਾਸ ਮੈਂ ਲਿਖਣਾ ਸੀਗਾ ਮੈਂ ਕਹਿ ਨਹੀਂ ਸਕਦਾ ਕਿ ਮੈਨੂੰ ਉਹ ਚੁੱਪ ਪਰਮਾਤਮਾ ਕਿਰਪਾਲ ਨਹੀਂ ਦਿੱਤੀ ਦਿਲ ਨੂੰ ਬੜੇ ਹੀ ਵਟਨੇ ਚੜ੍ਹਦੇ ਸੀਗੇ ਕਿ ਇਸ ਭਗਵਾਨ ਨੂੰ ਕੀ ਜਾਣਦਾ ਹੈ ਇਹ ਫਾਇਦਾ ਨਹੀਂ ਉਠਾਉਂਦਾ ਗਾ ਆਪਦੀ ਆਤਮਾ ਦੇ ਵਾਸਤੇ ਰਹਿਣ ਨਹੀਂ ਮੰਗਦਾ ਗਾ
Often I have told you this, that once when Master Kripal came to my ashram, one of his initiates, a very learned and educated person, came to see him. And first he started talking about this and that thing, which did not have any relevance to the teachings of the path. He just went on talking things about this and that. And then he said that, Master, I had written you a letter about my son getting sick and you had replied, but he did not become alright. And he went on saying things like that. I don't know that how the grace of Master Kripal kept me quiet at that time, but in my heart I was feeling so much excited and I was feeling so bad and so sorry for that person, that what he understands, Master Kripal, is well, when he asked for the grace from God, he has this God in front of him, and instead of asking for the mercy for his soul, he's asking for all these worldly things.
आत्मा समझते हैं आकर ना साधे माता ने जाना साथ ना पिता ने जाना ना बच्चिया ने जाना है अज शरीर दे विच असीं बैठे हैं ना इन्हें साधे साथ जाना है किराए का मकान है इत्थे छड जाना है अगर कोई साडा सच्चा मित्र है सारे साथ जाण वाला ओह साडा गुरु है
मास्टर टेल्स अस दैट इन द एंड नीदर आवर मदर इज गोइंग टू गो विद अस नॉर आवर फादर इज गोइंग टू गो विद अस None of our family members, the brothers, sisters, are going to go with us. Even this body in which we are sitting is not going to go with us. It is like a rented house. And when the time will come, we will have to leave everything here and we will have to go alone.
इसे जीनीदार देकर महात्मा ठहरे वो जीनीदार में आप भी जो करो जो परेशानी सी गरीबी सी वो बताई महात्मा प्रयावान ही दे नर्म दिल हम दे ਉਹਨਾਂ ਨੇ ਉਹਨੂੰ ਪਾਰਸ ਦੇ ਦਿੱਤਾ ਲੈ ਵੀ ਪਿਆਰਿਆ ਕਿਉਂ ਕਰੀ ਤੈਨੂੰ ਇਤਨਾ ਮਹੀਨਿਆਂ ਵਾਸਤੇ ਮੈਂ ਦਿੰਦਾ ਹੈ ਤੂੰ ਜਿਤਨਾ ਮਰਜ਼ੀ ਸੋਨਾ ਬਣਾ ਲਈ ਲੋਹਾ ਲਿਆਈ ਲੋਹਾ ਸਸਤਾ ਹੁੰਦਾ ਹੈ ਉਹ ਜੱਟ ਖੁਸ਼ ਹੋਇਆ ਬਾਜ਼ਾਰ ਗਿਆ ਖੁਸ਼ੀ ਖੁਸ਼ੀ ਕਿ ਮੈਂ ਲੋਹਾ ਲਿਆਵਾਂ ਉਹਦੇ ਜਾ ਕੇ ਭਾਅ ਪੁੱਛਿਆ ਉਹ ਕਹਿਣ ਲੱਗੇ ਕਿ 10 ਰੁਪਏ ਕਿਲੋ ਹੈ ਥੋੜੇ ਦਿਨ ਹੋਏ ਉਹਦੇ ਬਹੁਤ ਸਸਤਾ ਸੀਗਾ 2 ਰੁਪਏ ਕਿਲੋ ਸੀਗਾ ਉਹ ਕਹਿਣ ਲੱਗਿਆ ਮੈਂ ਫੇਰ ਆਊਂਗਾ ਜਿੱਥੇ 2 ਰੁਪਏ ਕਿਲੋ ਹੋਇਆ ਮੈਂ ਫੇਰ ਲੈ ਕੇ ਜਾਊਂਗਾ ਮੁੜੇ ਆਇਆ ਜਦ ਫੇਰ ਕਿਤੇ ਦਿਲ ਚ ਖਿਆਲ ਆਇਆ ਕਿ ਮਹਾਤਮਾ ਪਾਸ ਦੇ ਗਏ ਸੀ ਮੈਂ ਸੋਨਾ ਬਣਾ ਲੈਣਾ ਉਹ ਫੇਰ ਬਾਜ਼ਾਰ ਦੇ ਵਿੱਚ ਗਿਆ ਉਹਨਾਂ ਨੇ ਪੁੱਛਿਆ ਕਿ ਲੋਹੇ ਦਾ ਕੀ ਭਾਅ ਹੈ ਉਹ ਕਹਿੰਦੇ ਜੀ 100 ਰੁਪਇਆ ਕਿਲੋ ਹੋ ਗਿਆ ਹੈ ਥੋੜੇ ਦਿਨ ਹੋ ਗਏ ਉਦੋਂ 10 ਰੁਪਏ ਕਿਲੋ ਵਿਕਦਾ ਸੀਗਾ ਉਹ ਕਹਿਣ ਲੱਗਿਆ ਜਦ 10 ਰੁਪਏ ਕਿਲੋ ਹੋਏਗਾ ਮੈਂ ਫੇਰ ਆ ਕੇ ਲੈ ਜਾਊਂਗਾ ਹੁਣ ਤੁਸੀਂ ਸੋਚ ਕੇ ਦੇਖ ਲਓ ਉਸ ਜੱਟ ਨੂੰ ਇਹ ਨੀ ਪਤਾ ਕਿ ਆਖਰ ਜਿਹੜਾ ਸੋਨਾ ਹੈ ਉਹ ਕਿੰਨਾ ਵਜਨ ਦੇ ਵਿੱਚ ਵੱਧ ਜਾਏਗਾ ਮੇਰਾ ਕਿੰਨਾ ਫਾਇਦਾ ਹੋ ਜਾਏਗਾ ਲੇਕਿਨ ਉਹਨੂੰ ਇਸ ਚੀਜ਼ ਦਾ ਗਿਆਨ ਨਹੀਂ ਗਾ ਔਰ ਉਹ ਮੁੜਿਆ ਆਉਂਦਾ ਵਾਪਸ ਤਿੰਨਾਂ ਮਹੀਨਿਆਂ ਤੋਂ ਬਾਅਦ ਮਹਾਤਮਾ ਆਏ ਉਹਨਾਂ ਨੇ ਦੇਖਿਆ ਉਸ ਜੀਨੀਦਾਰ ਦੀ ਉਹੀ ਖਸਤਾ ਹਾਲਤ ਉਹੀ ਗਰੀਬੀ ਲੱਖ ਲੱਖ ਚੜੀ ਹੋਈ ਘਰ ਦੇ ਵਿੱਚ ਉਹ ਕਹਿਣ ਲੱਗੇ ਪਿਆਰਿਆ ਤੈਨੂੰ ਅਸੀਂ ਪਾਸ ਦੇ ਗਏ ਸੈਂ ਤੈਂ ਉਹਦਾ ਕੋਈ ਫਾਇਦਾ ਨਹੀਂ ਉਠਾਇਆ ਉਹਨੇ ਦੱਸਿਆ ਕਿ ਕਿਹੜਾ ਫਾਇਦਾ ਤਾਂ ਉਠਾ ਲੈਂਦਾ ਪਰ ਲੋਹਾ ਜਿਹੜਾ ਸੀ ਉਹ ਮਹਿੰਗਾ ਹੋ ਗਿਆ ਉਹ ਕਹਿਣ ਲੱਗੇ ਲੋਹੇ ਦੇ ਨਾਲ ਸੋਨਾ ਵੀ ਮਹਿੰਗਾ ਹੋਇਆ ਹੋਏਗਾ ਉਹ ਜੀਨੀਦਾਰ ਚੁੱਪ
ਵਾਂਸ ਮਹਾਤਮਾ ਵੈਂਟ ਟੂ ਅ ਫਾਰਮਰਸ ਹੋਮ ਐਂਡ ਹੀ ਸਟੇਡ ਦੈਟ ਦ ਫਾਰਮਰ ਟੋਲਡ ਦੈਟ ਮਹਾਤਮਾ about the difficulty, the problem he had in his home. He was poor, so he asked the Mahatma to shower grace upon him. You know that masters are very soft-hearted, they are merciful ones, they are the gracious ones. So when that farmer requested the master, requested to that Mahatma to shower grace on him, Mahatma gave a philosopher's stone to that farmer, saying that, I am giving this to you for 3 months, and buy some iron from the market and convert that into the gold, which is very expensive, and you can sell that in the market, and then in that way your poverty will go away and you will become a rich person. After that, Mahatma left that place. Now that farmer, he went in the market to buy some iron, and he asked that how much was the iron. So they said that it is 10 rupees a kilo, but until a couple of days ago, it used to sell for 2 rupees a kilo, but now it has become expensive. So he said that, okay, I'll come back when it drops down to 2 rupees a kilo. So he came back without buying any iron, And then for some time he forgot that the Mahatma had given him a philosopher's stone. But when he remembered, because when he was bothered by his poverty, he again remembered. So he went in the market and asked the price of the iron. They told him that now it is selling for 100 rupees a kilo. But some time ago it was selling only for 10 rupees a kilo. So he said that, okay, I'll come back when it comes back to 10 rupees a kilo. So he didn't buy any and he came back without realizing that gold was more expensive, and if he had bought the iron even at the rate of 100 rupees a kilo, he would have made a lot of money by selling, by converting that iron into gold and by selling that gold. But he did not realize that, so he came back. And in this way, that time went by and he did not take advantage of the philosopher's stone which the Mahatma had given to him. 3 months later, the Mahatma came back thinking that by now the farmer would have made a lot of gold and he would have made a lot of money and he would be living more comfortably now. But when he saw him living in the same poor condition, even worse, miserable condition, he was surprised and he asked him that, dear one, I had given you a philosopher's stone. Why didn't you convert the iron into gold and why didn't you become rich? He said that, Master, I wish I could have done that. But the problem was that whenever I went to the market, I found that the iron was very expensive. It was going up and up. So that is why I didn't buy the iron and I did not make any gold. Mahatma realized, Mahatma said that, dear one, you know, that the gold was more expensive than the iron. So it would have been better for you to buy the iron at any price, at any cost, and turn it into gold. The farmer realized his mistake and he kept quiet. He did not have any answer.
ਮਨ ਸਾਡਾ ਲੋਹਾ ਹੈ, ਨਾਮ ਪਾਰਸ ਹੈ। ਅਸੀਂ ਜਦ ਮਹਾਤਮਾ ਦੇ ਪਾਸ ਜਾਂਦੇ ਹਾਂ, ਅਸੀਂ ਵੀ ਰੂਹਾਨੀਅਤ ਦੀ ਤਰਫ ਕੰਗਾਲ ਹੁੰਦੇ ਹਾਂ, ਦੁਆਲੀਆ ਕੱਢੇ ਬੈਠੇ ਹੁੰਦੇ ਹਾਂ। ਉਹ ਸਾਡੇ 'ਤੇ ਰਹਿਮ ਕਰਦੇ ਆ, ਉਹ ਸਾਨੂੰ ਆਪਦਾ ਨਾਮ ਪਾਰਸ ਦਿੰਦੇ ਆ ਕਿ ਦੇਖ ਪਿਆਰਿਆ, ਅਗਰ ਤੂੰ ਇਸ ਨੂੰ ਮਨ ਦੇ ਨਾਲ ਲਾਏਗਾ, ਇਹ ਜਿਹੜਾ ਮਨ ਤੇਰਾ ਬੁਰਿਆਈਆਂ ਕਰਦਾ ਹੈ ਇਹ ਸਾਫ਼ ਹੋ ਜਾਏਗਾ। ਲੇਕਿਨ ਅਸੀਂ ਕੀ ਕਰਦੇ ਹਾਂ,
it is just a story. What is the meaning of the story? Our mind is like the iron, and the naam which our master has given to us is the philosopher's stone. Master has given us this philosopher's stone so that touching the mind with the naam, we may remove all the impurities of the mind, we may make it pure, and we may make it more valuable. But instead of doing the similar to the mind, instead of touching the mind with the naam, we don't use it, we don't do the simran. So that is why when the masters give us the naam, they want us to do the simran. They want us to make our mind do the simran, which we don't. And that is why, that is how we do not take advantage of the philosopher's stone, the naam which the master has graciously given to us.
Sant Mahatma, naam deke ਸੇ ਬਦਵਾਸ ਕਰਦੇ ਹੈ ਕਿ ਕਾਹਦੇ ਮਨ ਇੰਦਰੀਆਂ ਦੀ ਗੁਲਾਮੀ ਤੋਂ ਆਜ਼ਾਦ ਹੋਵੇ, ਕਾਹਦੇ ਆਪਣੀ ਆਤਮਾ ਨੂੰ ਖੁਸ਼ਹਾਲ ਕਰੇ। ਲੇਕਿਨ ਉਹ ਜਦ ਆਉਂਦੇ ਹੈ ਇਹੀ ਆਸ ਰੱਖ ਕੇ ਕਿ ਸਾਡੇ ਸੇਵਕ ਖੁਸ਼ਹਾਲ ਹੋਣਗੇ, ਕਾਫ਼ੀ ਉਹਨਾਂ ਨੇ ਭਜਨ ਸਿਮਰਨ ਕੀਤਾ ਹੋਵੇਗਾ, ਸਾਡੀ ਅੱਗੋਂ ਉਹੀ ਹਾਲਤ ਹੁੰਦੀ ਹੈ। ਬਹੁਤ ਸਾਰੇ ਪ੍ਰੇਮੀ ਜਦ ਜਾਂਦੇ ਹੈ ਉਹ ਕਹਿੰਦੇ ਜੀ ਸਾਨੂੰ ਮਨ ਹੀ ਨਹੀਂ ਬੈਠਣ ਦਿੰਦਾ।
After giving the initiation, the master expects a lot from his disciple, and he always looks forward to that time when the disciples would rise above the organs of senses and when the disciples would rise above the mind and when they would do the meditation and when they would purify themselves. So that is why whenever the masters come to the disciples, they always expect to see the disciples in a better condition. But unfortunately, since the disciples do not use that philosopher's stone, because they do not make their mind do the simran, they do not rise above the tricks of the mind. That is why they always remain in the same condition, and that disappoints the master.
Sanu pata hi hai, agar apni bhajan simran nahi kar dege, assi kis tarah tarakki kar sakte hain? Main dekha hai, jehde premi dehri rakhe hai, satsang karde hai, ਆਪਣਾ ਅਭਿਆਸ ਰੋਜ਼ ਕਰਦੇ ਹੈ। ਬੜਾ ਟਾਈਮ ਹੋ ਗਿਆ ਮੈਨੂੰ ਉਹਨਾਂ ਨੂੰ ਮਿਲਦਿਆਂ ਨੂੰ, ਉਹਨਾਂ ਕੋਲ ਕੋਈ ਸਵਾਲ ਨਹੀਂ ਹੁੰਦਾ ਗਾ। ਉਹ ਕਹਿੰਦੇ ਦਰਸ਼ਨ ਕਰਨ ਵਾਸਤੇ ਆਏ ਹੈ। ਲੇਕਿਨ ਬਹੁਤ ਸਾਰੇ ਪੁਰਾਣੇ ਸਤਸੰਗੀ ਮਿਲਦੇ ਆ ਜਿਹਨਾਂ ਨੂੰ ਵੀ 22 ਸਾਲ ਹੋ ਗਏ ਨਾਮ ਲਿਆ ਨੂੰ, ਉਹ ਨਾ ਡੈਰੀ ਰੱਖਦੇ ਆ ਜੋ ਪਰਮ ਪਿਤਾ ਕਿਰਪਾਲ ਨੇ ਬਿਤਾਈ ਸੀ, ਨਾ ਆਪਣਾ ਅਭਿਆਸ ਕਰਦੇ ਆ, ਨਾ ਸਤਸੰਗ ਦੇ ਵਿੱਚ ਜਾਂਦੇ ਹੈ। ਜਦ ਮੈਨੂੰ ਮਿਲਦੇ ਹੈ ਉਹ ਬੜੇ ਢੇਰ ਸਾਰੇ ਸਵਾਲ ਲਿਖ ਕੇ ਲੈ ਆਉਂਦੇ ਹੈ, ਮੈਂ ਉਹਨਾਂ ਨੂੰ ਪਿਆਰ ਨਾਲ ਕਹਿੰਦਾ ਪੁੱਛਦਾ ਹੈ ਕਿਉਂਕਿ ਡੈਰੀ ਰੱਖਦਾ ਹੁੰਦਾ, ਸਤਸੰਗ ਚ ਕਦੇ ਗਿਆ ਹੈ? ਉਹ ਕਹਿਣ ਲੱਗਾ ਜੀ ਮੈਂ ਤੁਹਾਨੂੰ ਸੁਣ ਕੇ ਇੱਥੇ ਆਇਆ, ਮੈਂ ਤਾਂ ਕਦੇ ਗਿਆ ਨੀ।
They say that, Master, our mind does not let us sit in the meditation. You dear ones, you know that the mind will never let you sit in the meditation. You have to make him sit in the meditation. You know that we cannot progress on this path until we do the meditation, until we make our mind sit in the meditation, until we attend the satsangs and until we keep the diary. I meet many dear ones whom I have been seeing for a long time, those who do the meditations regularly, those who keep the diary, those who go to the satsangs, and those who are living according to the teachings of the path. When they come to see me, they do not have any questions for me. They say that, Master, we have come only for your darshan, we don't have any questions. So those dear ones, those who do the meditations regularly, and those who do the diary, and those who go to the satsang, they do not have any questions, and when they come to see me, they enjoy, they have the darshan. Whereas, there are many dear ones, those who were initiated 20 or 22 years ago, very long time initiated, but those who have not kept the diary, those who have not gone to the satsang, and those who have hardly done any meditation, when they come to see me, they bring long pages of questions to ask me, and when I ask them lovingly, the dear one, do you keep the diary, do you go to the satsang, do you meditate regularly, they say that, Master, we have come here, this is the first time for us to come in the satsang in such a long time, and we don't do any diary, we don't do the meditation. So dear ones, how can you progress in the path if you are not doing your meditation?
ਮਨ ਸਾਡਾ ਲੋਹਾ ਹੈ, ਔਰ ਅਗਰ ਅਸੀਂ ਇਸ ਲੋਹੇ ਨੂੰ ਪਾਰਥ ਨਾਮ ਦਾ ਲਾਵਾਂਗੇ, ਇਹ ਪਵਿੱਤਰ ਹੋਏਗਾ। ਜਿੰਨੇ ਸਾਡੇ ਖਿਆਲ ਪਵਿੱਤਰ ਹੋਣਗੇ, ਉਹਨਾਂ ਮਨ ਪਵਿੱਤਰ ਹੋਏਗਾ, ਜਿੰਨਾ ਮਨ ਪਵਿੱਤਰ ਹੋਏਗਾ ਉਨੇ ਹੀ ਸਾਡੀ ਆਤਮਾ ਪਵਿੱਤਰ ਹੋਏਗੀ, ਆਤਮਾ ਪਵਿੱਤਰ ਹੋਏਗੀ ਤਾਂ ਇਹ ਸ਼ਬਦ ਨਾਲ ਫੌਰਨ ਜੁੜ ਜਾਏਗੀ, ਜੈਸੇ ਲੋਹਾ ਅੱਛਾ ਮੈਗਨੇਟ ਨਾਲ ਜੁੜ ਜਾਂਦਾ ਹੈ।
Dear ones, Sansad Gurus have given us this philosopher's stone, this naam. And if we will make our mind touch this philosopher's stone, it will become pure. When we will make our mind to the simran, it will become pure. The more good thoughts, the more pure thoughts we have, purer our mind will become. And the purer our mind is, purer our soul will become. And when our soul will become pure, then easily it will get connected and attracted to the shabad, and it will go back to the real home. It is like when you bring pure piece of iron in the contact of the magnet, it at once attracts it. In the same way, when we bring our soul, when we purify our soul, and when we bring the soul in the contact of the shabad, at once it goes and merges into the shabad.
Our closing bhajan is on page 256. Guru, 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 say Guru, Guru with love. You have got the human body with a great fortune. Take advantage of this. Meditate on the Naam as much as you can. However much you have slept thus far is enough. At least now open your eyes. Say Guru, Guru with love. Whoever has moved the rosary of the Naam of the Master with true heart, all his illusions and secrets were erased because such a light was manifested within. Drink the nectar of the Naam of the Guru. Make your life interesting. Say Guru, Guru with love. The holy Naam of the Master removes the heat of passions, curses and anxieties. The Satguru is hungry for the love and affection of the devotees, as was Krishna or Rama. The moments which are spent in the Simran are precious. Say Guru, Guru with love. Whenever the devotees remembered him, he came running barefoot. He always embraces the poor ones and he always gives support to the weak ones. O Kripalji, give me the arms of Nam. This is the request of a jay. Say Guru, Guru with love. Bhajan of Sanchi on page 256.
Guru, 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 Bola Prema Se Guru, Guru. Guru, 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 Bola Prema Se Guru, Guru. Pade Bhage Manas Tana Paya. Yes, kalava utale jitana nama diya sakata hai utana nama diya le pade bhage manas tan paya yes kalava utale Itana nama diya sakata hai, itana nama diya le. Jitana soya bahi bhagota hai, avato anke kola prema se guru guru. Guru 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 bola prema se guru 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 bola prema se guru guru jisne pere sach man se Guru Namaki Mala Jitana Bede Brahmate Mitagia Esa Hua Ujala Jisane Pere Sachamanase Guru Namaki Mala Jitane Bede Brahmate Mitagaya Esa Hua Ujala Guru Namaki Amarita Pile Jivana Me Rasa Gola Prema Se Guru 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 Bola prema se guru 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 bola prema se guru guru tapa shapa santapa mitata guru kapavana namaha Prema buhava ke buke sate guru Krishna kaho ya rama Tapa shapa santapa mitata Guru kapavana nama Prema buhava ke buke sate guru Krishna kauya rama jo pala simaran me bita hai behe pala hai anmola prema se guru 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 bola prema se guru Guru, 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 Bola Prema Se Guru, Guru. Yad kiya java bahi bhagotane, nange pero dodaya, saradine ko gale lagaya. Saradiya Durabhav Ko Sahara Yad ਕੀਆ ਜਵ ਪਾਈ ਮਗੋਤ ਨੇ ਨੰਗੇ ਪੈਰੋ ਡੋਡਾਇਆ ਸਰ ਦਿਨ ਕੋ ਗਾਲੇ ਲਗਾਇਆ ਸਰ ਦੀਆ ਦੂਰ ਬਾਪ ਹੋ ਸਹਾਰਾ ਕੇਰ ਨਾਮ ਕੀ ਪਾਵੋ ਕਿਰਪਾਲ ਜੀ ਅਜਾਇਬ ਰਾਹ ਬੋਲਾ ਪ੍ਰੇਮ ਸੇ ਗੁਰੂ 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 ਬੋਲਾ ਪ੍ਰੇਮ ਸੇ ਗੁਰੂ
Guru, 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 say Guru, Guru with love. May God bless us all.